Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Friday, the 10th of July. A delight to have you all with us. Thank you very much for being here. Let me introduce everybody to you. We have a wonderful panel this morning and what promises to be a good conversation, and I am very happy that you are a part of it. You can join in by simply emailing us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. So let us welcome the group. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Primed and raring to go on this wonderful end of the week, Friday.
Yes, Friday. It feels good. It feels right. A little warm, but that's all right. We'll get through that. It feels like a weekend, so we'll take it. And I thank you. It's wonderful to have you here. We also welcome Judith Enk, former EPA Regional Administrator, visiting professor at Bennington College, and president of Beyond Plastics. Judith, good morning. How are you?
Good. Is it still 2020?
Yeah.
I just want the year to go along.
You know, about a week ago, there was a cartoon, and I want to attribute it to The New Yorker because all good cartoons should be attributed to The New Yorker, but I'm not sure it was. But it was like three people, and on the back of their coats it said "us," and it just had them opening the door, which was labeled July, just sort of peering around the outside, mm-hmm. looking in, kind of hoping for the best, but being very mm-hmm. frightened. And now that we're 10 days into the month, we know why.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But a good point, Judith. We are also thrilled to have Aaron Pasitti with us. He is the Siena College economics professor. There are others there, but he's the one we care about. Good morning, Aaron. How are you? Hello. Oh, I got to press a button. Go ahead, Aaron. How are you?
Good morning. Hi, everyone.
Nice to have you here. Thank you very much for being with us. Last mm-hmm. night, somewhere around, midnight, I called Rosemary and I said, hey, can you be on the show? And she said, sure, I'd love to be. We had a last-minute cancellation. So UAlbany adjunct professor and investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo is with us. Rosemary, thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for telling everyone that I'm second choice. I so appreciate that.
You were my first choice.
Your first second choice.
As a backup. But thank you.
You're our own Janet Reno.
Yeah.
I'm excited to be on with you again, Rosemary.
I know. I was thinking how long it's been since I've been on with you and Aaron, and that's very cool. Alan, I see you all the time, so
yeah,
I'm not
too
really
much.
Leaving
too
you
much,
out.
I'm sure. So I have a question for you, Rosemary, very quickly. What's better, a fig Newton or a chocolate covered graham cracker?
Oh,
chocolate covered graham cracker. Not even close.
Not even close, Alan. I agree with Rosemary.
Me too. However, I've just eaten the last of the chocolate-covered graham crackers, and I'm up to the Fig Newtons, and I don't know if I can take it.
Oh, it's like me then. Second choice. Perfect.
Oh, Rosemary, you're our little Fig Newton.
Sharper than a serpent's tooth.
Well, good morning and welcome all. It's a delight to have you here. Again, we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. All right. So yesterday we kind of bumbled through in getting the dribs and drabs of information that was coming out regarding the Supreme Court's tax decision. And one of the things that when we left the panel, we had most of the information, but we still had not had a reaction from the president. Well, that came, of course, in the form of a tweet, and it has made the president upset. His angry reaction underscores a political risk, says the Washington Post. He reacted angrily to a pair of Supreme Court rulings about his financial records Thursday, taking to Twitter to call them, quote, not fair to this presidency or administration, and describing himself as the victim of a, quote, political prosecution. Hours later, the White House released a statement saying Trump was gratified by one of the decisions and had been protected in the other. The disjointed responses underscore what in some ways represented a split decision for the president, marked by political and legal ramifications that hold both risks and advantages ahead of November elections. Well, it appears that Trump will be able to keep his financial records and tax returns out of the public eye between now and the election. The court rejected his lawyer's claims of absolute immunity and sent one of the cases back to the lower court for further litigation. The decision will give Democrats, including presumptive presidential nominee Joe Biden, more ammunition in their attempts to raise ethical questions about a president who has fought relentlessly to keep his financial records out of the public eye. That, according to Russell Riley, a presidential historian at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Alan, what do you think?
Well, first of all, I am one of those, or I don't know others, but I truly believe that this was a huge victory for those people who have been opposed to the president's assertion of, being a single voice in charge of everything. This decision said, and properly so, nobody is above the law. Now, we're not going to see the tax returns, and that's somewhat troubling. But I think the fact that the principle was articulated is more important than anything else. And that is a huge win because it comes from one of the so-called coordinate branches of government, the Supreme Court. And they said, you can't make that claim. So from where I'm sitting, it was a pretty definitive win.
Judith Henk.
Yeah, I completely agree. You also get the feeling that Chief Justice John Roberts is just really working hard to hold the country together. Trump has singularly attacked almost every institution that is part of America, including the post office, for goodness sakes. And I think it's interesting that Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, the two Trump appointees to the Supreme Court, went along with the said decision. We won't see Trump's tax returns, but we will see Mary Trump's book on Tuesday, which I think has a lot of the details that you would have seen in the tax return. I mean, she turned over boxes and boxes of Trump family financial documents to the New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning team, Suzanne Craig and others, and a lot of that will be chronicled again in the book. So in a certain way, even though she has a gag order, the reporters that have read the book are reporting on it, that book is telling the story of what we would have seen in the tax returns. And then my final point is the very distinguished Neil Katyal, who has argued dozens of cases in the Supreme Court. You probably know him as a media commentator. He takes a very different position than virtually every other media voice on this. He thinks that Cyrus Vance, the DA in Manhattan, can move very fast with a grand jury, and a grand jury may indeed hand up some criminal charges against the president before the November election. That would be interesting.
You are right about one thing there, Judith, a lot of things, but one thing that really stands out is that this is a huge victory for Cy Vance. This is not a popular mm-hmm. district attorney. He's been in a lot of mm-hmm. trouble with a lot of people. And boy, this is something that will increase his fortunes.
Yeah, and it's very much in the hands of the grand jury, and not to stereotype, but I think, a New York City grand jury might be very interested in bringing charges against a president who's just been so horrible to New York City. And finally, what's so significant about Cyrus Vance Jr. getting the documents for his case is I believe this is the first time that presidential documents were ordered to be handed over to a non-federal prosecutor. And remember, Cy Vance does not answer to Donald Trump the way Bill Barr does. So I would keep a really close eye on that New York City investigation.
Yeah, but let's remember one thing. As I guess our former and now and disgraced Chief Justice in New York State once said, a grand jury would indict a ham sandwich if the DA told them to. The DA, the grand jury is hardly the definitive voice. It's what the DA wants, and that's what he's going to get.
Let me ask, Aaron, what do you think? What does The Economist make of this?
Yeah, this is interesting. I actually had to do a double take yesterday and this morning to make sure I was reading this right in terms of the 7-2 decision and the statement that the president is not immune from criminal proceedings while in office. So I want to second what Alan said. I also want to mention that David Soros, who I'm sure we all dearly miss, said this way back when, that a lot of the action with Trump's alleged wrongdoings are going to come not out of congressional investigations, but, you know, local DAs, like what's happening with Cy Vance in Manhattan. So this is going to be interesting. But to me, there's legitimate reasons that a president should release their tax returns. One is just an advanced signal that they have nothing to hide. It creates the optics of transparency. It follows, 50 years of precedent. It can reveal any financial conflicts of interest a president might have, particularly one with a business empire as large as Trump, and campaign making sure that the president is following campaign finance laws. So there's a lot of good reasons that a president would want to release their tax returns. So this begs the question, what could possibly be in Trump's tax returns that he is going to such lengths to hide? So obviously any violation of the things I just mentioned, and obviously Cy Vance is investigating the campaign finance laws and the hush money payments. But I think it could also show that Trump very legally abused the tax code, taking advantage of, tax write-offs, advanced depreciation, stuff that is entirely legal, but shows just how porous the U.S. tax code is. It could also reveal, and I think this is probably a much larger factor in it, that Trump did not earn as much as he says he earned, meaning he wants to create an image of, a wealthy, successful businessman, but his tax returns might suggest something very, very different that does not play into his narcissistic worldview. And finally, that, his wealth comes from gifts and things other than business earnings, essentially inherited wealth instead of earned income. So given what we know about the president and his personality, it seems like he's very clearly trying to hide something. And if I had to wager money, I would bet that he's trying to hide the fact that he is not as wealthy as he says he is.
Rosemary, you touched on this yesterday, but what do you think today?
Okay, so I disagree with Alan. I don't think this was a Trump loss at all, despite his own confusion on the fact. I think Roberts is trying to hold the country together, but we are being jubilant over a ruling that basically says no man is above the law. That's all that this does. And that's big. Could have gone the other way, and then we'd be in trouble. But Trump is going to skate on this. We're not going to see his tax returns. The public may never see them. And I don't think even Cyrus Vance is going to see them before November, because they'll go back into the grand jury, and then Sekulow and the other Trump lawyers will do all the things that any other criminal defendant does to squash a subpoena and to hide evidence. So we have months of still wrangling ahead. So by playing out the clock, which is an old legal trick of his, I think he's won the battle for at least this election. Second, the decision shows to me how much we are reliant right now for the continuance of our democracy on the judiciary. The Supreme Court, including with two kind of dangerous Trump picks that went a different way. I'm so happy about that. That's the best news of this. But that's the only thing between us and a ruling that could have said, yes, the president is a supreme power. He is a king. The third thing is that it shows to me how difficult it will be to undo all the damage of the Trump years. to get this. This was a ruling, at least legally, in favor of our side, the Democratic side. And yet to fix it, look what has to be done. You have to put into law that presidents have to show their tax returns. You're going to have to put into law that you can or cannot indict or investigate or do anything to a president when he's still in office. All of those things that we took for granted, they're not. And getting them into law is going to take a whole lot of time. And the last thing I want to ask is, what the heck happened to Michael Cohen? He's been hustled back off to jail. Was that to shut him up? Very suspicious, and I don't think I have the whole story on that.
Under the right of reply, I want to just say, Rosemary said she disagreed with me. I don't think so. I think we agree on most of what she's just said. Nevertheless, the principle, which had never been articulated by this court before, that no man is above the law, is a terribly important thing, Rosemary, and I think at least we got that.
Yeah, I that is true, and it will be important in the future. Nobody else is going to be able to try what Trump did. He was the first to try it, God help us, and it won't happen again. But as for him, he once again is not going to feel the consequences of his bad behavior. He's done that his whole life, and I think this counts too.
I think he's been severely reprimanded by this court by saying that no man is above the law. And most people's eyes would glaze over when they got through with what was going on with his tax returns, if they got to see it. I think the principle is much more important.
I would.
And there's one other.
You go ahead. Go ahead, Rosemary.
Go ahead. I want to say there's one other thing. Judith talked about Mary Trump's book. We do not have to wait for Mary Trump's book to know what it says about his taxes. She was the source, as she revealed in the book, of all the information that went into the New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning story. The problem was that she got those records by being involved in a lawsuit with her evil uncle. And that ended long before he was running for president. So we don't know what he's worth now. We don't know how he ran his business. We don't know who his debtors are. We don't know what kind of business he was doing with Russians and other nefarious people before we elected him. So it's not like Mary Trump is a substitution for these records that Congress has been trying to get.
Well, it may have won us a Pulitzer Prize, but my point was that if this information gets out, like that information got out, people's eyes would glaze over. How many people are talking about that story and what it showed, Rosemary, when they discuss Trump and his taxes?
We're out of time right now, but we can you hold your reply to the other side of the break, Rosemary?
Sure.
Excellent. I'll let you do. Thank you for being so compliant. I will. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll hear what Rosemary has to say about this. I would like to get into the Michael Cohen thing, too, because it is fascinating. We'll talk about that and much more right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. When we left, Rosemary was about to make a point in a conversation with following up on what Alan was saying. So, Rosemary, we'll go to you.
Okay, except I've totally forgotten it.
Okay.
I even forgot what we were talking about.
Well, let me ask you about Michael Cohen then. That was one thing that you brought up, and I did want to get back to the Michael Cohen story. Return to federal court. So apparently what we're being told is that he was upset about signing an agreement not to publish a book while serving his sentence at home. That according to his legal advisor, and that was what sent him back to jail. Mr. Cohen, believing the agreement violated his First Amendment rights, refused to sign it. The advisor, Lanny Davis, said less than 2 hours later, federal marshals stepped out of an elevator with handcuffs and took Mr. Cohen back into custody. So what are your concerns, Rosemary?
Okay, that's really suspicious. I think he was put back in jail because they didn't want him talking about this Supreme Court decision, which really leaves him as the only person to be punished, to be held account of for what happened with the campaign financing violation when he paid off Stormy Daniels. He is privy to all kinds of information about that and would have been a logical person for anyone in the media to talk to. And I think they hustled him out of way. He also would be able to talk perhaps about the efforts of the bar to take uh, to to redo the leadership of the Southern District of New York. So I think it's just highly suspicious. It was weird that he got out in the first place. And, of course, we know that Trump and Barr have a long record of punishing Trump enemies and rewarding his friends. So I think he got jerked over again.
Well, I think part of this is he was supposed to not talk to any media if he was released. And then B, his attorney is now saying this may prevent the publication of his book. So, yes, what Rosemary just said, but also I think the book is supposed to come out before November. So this could be a very, you know, suspicious, heavy-handed effort, you know, once again, for the president to try to block the publication of a book about him.
Well,
yeah, I like that.
Well, I hate to be a contrarian, because I believe what you guys are saying makes a great deal of sense. He was being punished, they were worried about him and all that. Nevertheless, he did put himself into the jaws of the shark by going to a restaurant when he was under home confinement. And he certainly must have known that they were out to get him, right?
Yeah, that was really stupid on his part, but I don't think that's the reason why.
No, you're probably right.
Why? Yeah. And also, dining? Why is he dining indoors? You know, it's
without a mask. Without a mask.
Outdoors. Was that a patio?
Was it a patio? Yeah.
Oh, it looked indoors. That was indoors. The first.
He did not commit that crime.
Okay. Well, I hope he had a good crime. Meal. Imagine it's like, how was the food? Meh. And now you're going back to jail. I hope it was tasty.
A year and a half more in jail. Yeah.
All right, let's go to, I'm just interested in this because there's so much going on here, but with the Trump tax decision, I guess, what information could he have, Rosemary, that he wouldn't have already shared, I guess?
Who do you mean, Cohen?
Yes, Cohen.
Well, anything related to a campaign finance charge, lots and lots of information about how Trump played fast and loose with evaluations of his property, of his asset worth. And he's the one who did that. Also, don't forget, Mary, Trump's book is out, and there's a whole bunch in there about school cheating. And we know that Cohen was the person who Trump enlisted to call his high school and college people and threaten them with all kinds of evil things if they let out his grades. So I think he was just in a position to be a big talker, and Trump got rid of him. That's what I think.
Mm. You know, we have a federal... Sorry, go ahead, please.
Go ahead. Well, remember, Vance is looking at the financial records of the last 8 to 10 years, including the hush money payments to those two poor women who had to deal with Trump. But he's also looking at tax irregularities. So it's been widely reported that shell companies have been set up to avoid paying gift taxes. And I think Cohen, Alan Weisselberg, is right in the middle of all of that. So Michael Cohen has salacious details of the hush money payments, but he also has some pretty important information on how Trump attempted to avoid paying taxes.
That's right. Cool. He set up a shell company to pay off Stormy Daniels and hide that,
right.
Didn't he?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. So there's also an analysis in the New York Times that talks about what the court did yesterday and trying to get a handle on where we are with the Supreme Court right now. And the article that the Times has is a conservative court and Trump's own appointees declare their independence. And at a campaign rally last month in Tulsa, President Trump ranked his Supreme Court appointees among his biggest achievements. Two great Supreme Court justices, he boasted. So we have two justices of the Supreme Court, Justice Gorsuch, Justice Kavanaugh. They're great. He might not have felt so warmly on Thursday after justices Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh categorically dismissed his claim to absolute immunity from investigators seeking his tax returns in a pair of far-reaching rulings. Mr. Trump's two appointees joined a unanimous conclusion that the president went too far by pronouncing himself exempt from legal scrutiny. How much should we make of that, do you think, Alan?
Well, if I may, Joe, I don't want to deviate because I've been sitting here with this question on my mind for Rosemary, who is our appointed Supreme Court person who's been looking at these guys. It is interesting, isn't it, Rosemary, that both decisions, the one that really went against Trump and the one that sort of protected him about the Congress, which I thought was a stupid ruling, which is, don't tell me that Nancy Pelosi and Richie Neal and these other guys didn't sit down with the best lawyers available and come up with the best, they said, well, it wasn't really complete. What a bunch of baloney. And so my question to you is, it's fascinating, isn't it, that both decisions came out 7-2. And what I was going to ask you, Rosemary, was, you know, we know they conference and that they trade horses and they do the rest of that stuff. Yeah. So it looks to me like in order to get one decision, which was the primary decision, they came down with a stupid one about Congress, which was really very important. What do you think, Rosemary?
I think that you are right, and I think you see the hand of John Roberts in this. Roberts knew that to help further legitimize his court, he does not want to be a Trump flunky. He has to sign on one or both of the Trump appointees, and he did that by slipping and sliding and manipulating, and it's called compromise. We used to have all the branches of government work with this way, and it was a good idea. It is a good thing. Also, Trump underestimated his own people. He has this twisted idea about loyalty. I gave you this lifetime appointment, and therefore you owe me unquestioning loyalty. Supreme Court justices do not work that way. And so you've seen Gorsuch especially. I'm really fascinated with him. He has gone against Trump several times, but has remained true to his own principles, which is you look at the text of the law and you follow it to whatever end, liberal, conservative. If that's what the text says, you go with it. And that's what he's done. And Roberts knows that and has manipulated him, not manipulated him in a bad sense. He's moved him. He has persuaded him using that argument to go the way of the court. I also think Kagan is working really hard to get along with the conservatives. And again, I do not see that as a bad thing. We have a court that it would be nice if presidents appointed moderates, if there were all Merrick Garlands in there who could see either side of an argument. But in this case where we have a really partisan court, you have a Supreme Court justice in there trying to look for the common ground and the agreed upon principles, that's great. That's the way a court should work.
You know, that's well, all I, that, yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
I think that is such an important point that Trump forgot that these were lifetime appointments and everything with him is transactional. And Kavanaugh and Gorsuch do not owe him anything right now.
Right.
It's impossible for me to say anything positive about Kavanaugh. But I will say during Gorsuch's confirmation hearings, when a senator asked him, are you going to rule against the person who appointed you? He made a very what looked like credible and passionate statement that essentially what Mario Cuomo used to say, the law is the law. It doesn't matter who appointed him. And just an example of how transactional Trump is, even when it comes to COVID, I'm sure you all noticed the new beautiful mural on Fifth Avenue in front of Trump Tower. The
Black
iconic,
Lives Matter.
Yes, the Black Lives
you mean
Matter.
That hate new-
He didn't like it. Our new monuments, those wonderful street murals. And last night when the president was being interviewed on Fox, he just exploded against Mayor de Blasio, saying, I gave de Blasio everything he asked for. I gave him ventilators. I gave him shields. I gave him masks. And this is what he does to me. Well, first of all, they're not his ventilators. You know, federal taxpayers paid for it in order to keep people alive. And just because New York City got some medical equipment, the mayor is not supposed to allow Black Lives Matter to be painted conveniently in front of Trump Tower right when he will look out the window and see it all the time.
I keep trying to make one point, which has been assiduously ignored by everybody, so I probably am not right, but I want to make it one more time. Roberts is a political animal. He got ahead by being a political animal. And while we ascribe all kinds of good things to him, Rosemary, the fact is he was appointed by the Bushes. And Bush hated and hates Donald Trump. So I am not surprised. I think there may be a political element. I don't think it's the whole thing, but there may be a willingness on Roberts' part to say, okay, I'm not owned. I owe my loyalty to a different group of people.
I don't know if we're saying the same thing, Alan. I think when Roberts was appointed, Donald Trump was far from anyone's mind, especially the Bushes, as a possible presidential contender. So yeah. I don't see that his appointment had anything to do with it. And I don't see that any Bush is now in a position where they're having meetings with Roberts, giving him marching orders. But I do think that he's looking at his legacy.
Nor did I say, Rosemary, that he's getting marching orders. I think he comes from a milieu, from a group of people who assiduously hate Trump's guts right now. And the Bushes have been pretty clear about that. I don't think anybody's saying, now you go out and rule against him. I think it's part of what enters into his thinking.
Well, he's not an extremist.
Why? Go ahead. Rosemary.
Go ahead, who?
Go ahead, Rosemary.
Okay. I think that Roberts is offended by the sloppiness and incomplete work and the arrogance of the lawyering that's been put before him by the Trump administration. And he has repeatedly made rulings that are against Trump, but they come with proviso saying, this is what you should have done, and you didn't. Therefore, I'm saying no to you. That's not the same as saying, I hate your ideas.
Judith?
Right. And along those lines, when they ruled on DACA, they gave the Trump administration the roadmap on how to do DACA the right way.
Right.
And repeal it. And apparently next week, they will be rolling out new federal regulations to repeal DACA, quote, the right way.
Right.
That they're going to do that. So Rosemary's right. It's sloppy lawyering. What a surprise from Bill Barr. Roberts is by the book, but it is a little disconcerting that he is giving them the chance to do it again. I'd like to share my worst case nightmare scenario with our listeners and have someone walk me off the cliff here. I'm worried that Clarence Thomas, who's probably not happy with many of the late season decisions by the court, may retire this year so Trump can name his replacement by the end of the year.
Well, why is that so worrisome?
Because I don't like Clarence Thomas, but I don't want Trump appointing a 35-year-old Clarence Thomas.
Yeah, I see.
I want him to step down during the Biden administration so that Biden can appoint a new Supreme Court justice.
Well, with Mitch McConnell saying what he said about not appointing, within a year of an election, not that I think he will stay with that, but it's unlikely that Trump would get that chance unless he wins.
I think McConnell would do it in a heartbeat to get another.
You're probably right about that.
I think McConnell would, and I do think this is already in the works, but the Democrats have to also be thinking. And what you do is, if the Congress steamrolls it, and McConnell would definitely do that, then you challenge it in the next year. And then it would go to a Supreme Court that was not fully decided. It would be an 8-person Supreme Court, and you would have a fight then. Even the contextualists might go along with a different interpretation of advice and consent than McConnell has put forward.
Aaron, I know you're trying to get in on this conversation. We are going to a break, but go ahead.
I'll keep it quick then. I'm trying to talk Judith down. I don't think Clarence Thomas is that patriotic or dedicated to the conservative cause as much as he is his own.
You may be right.
Good point. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We have letters from listeners. We'll go to those, and then we'll move on to other topics. Great panel this morning. Alan Chartok, Judah Thank, Aaron Pasitti, and Rosemary Armeo. We'll continue our conversation right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion, listening to the music of Alison Brown this morning from the album The Song of the Banjo. Very cool stuff. You can find out our complete playlist by going to WAMC.org/roundtable. WAMC.org/roundtable. Let's go to some letters. We have a few here. Rosemary, now he's liable to criminal prosecution by New York. This is liable to, this is from Luigi, and I believe this is about Michael Cohen. Rosemary, now he's liable to criminal prosecution now by New York. He wasn't before. Isn't that a victory? Oh, this is about the Supreme Court decision. My apologies.
I think that's about Trump.
Yeah.
I think it's about Trump.
And yep.
Yeah, it's great. It's better than the alternative, but it's by no means that any kind of guarantee that he will be brought into court. We have a lack of appetite for going after political opponents once they're passed. And I will bring out Mr. Zinke, the former Secretary of the Interior under Trump, who was as corrupt as they come, caught red-handed, forced to leave. He has not been even indicted since then. We forget about him once they leave. And I think that's what's going to happen to Trump. I don't think he's ever going to go to jail. It feeds my view that once again, he's skated.
Rose or Judith, any thoughts on Zinke?
I am jumping for joy that someone remembers Zinke. I thought it was just me.
Oh, I do. And I mean, we had a discussion, Judith. I think you were there with David Soares, and he poo-pooed it and said, no, these things take time. Watch for it. So I've been keeping track. And as soon as David's back on, that's my first question to him. What about Zinke?
Yes.
Well, Rosemary, what rhymes with Zinke?
You're part of the Zinke
patrol.
That's
a good one, Al.
That is good.
We're going to hold Stinky Zinke accountable for years, even if no one else remembers his name.
All right, back to the letters. We go to Roger, who says, I think the court's decision yesterday has irreparably damaged the office of the president. This was a simple constitutional issue regarding the Constitution's supremacy clause. Simple. Now every local, and may I remind you, most are elected, will be subpoenaing presidential documents for political gain. Just a reminder, these chickens will come home to roost.
What do people have to fear if they're honest?
What are you going
to
do?
They're paying their taxes. Bring it on.
I mean, God forbid if a president breaks the law and a whole bunch of local officials go after him or governors go after him. Well, they shouldn't be allowed to do that because let him go scot-free. It's ridiculous. That's not a good letter.
Dave says that if you still need, we welcome your letters and we love them. And we'll even grade them, actually.
We love them. Yeah, well, that's what we all did for a living.
That's right. Dave says if you still need either Trump's taxes or Mary Trump's book to understand the depravity of this president, you probably should stay away from the voting booth. That doesn't make that book any more, any less vital to read, I don't think, though. But Douglas says, it's about the Russian money. That's Trump's fear. The financial records may also explain his insane affection for Putin. Follow the money, says Douglas.
I agree with Douglas. Mm-hmm. Douglas is right.
Let's see. This comes from Doodle Captain. How the heck are locals supposed to afford housing when all these New York City people are trying to leave the city due to COVID-19? They come up here, create no jobs, and worse, eliminate jobs by buying property where businesses used to be. The state is a joke that revolves around New York City. So they're upset.
Well, that was kind and considerate to people trying to avoid a life-threatening illness. There is one thread there that I think makes sense, and only one, is as housing patterns are changing, there needs to be some planning for affordable housing for long-term residents so people do not get priced out of their community. But it can be done in a thoughtful, logical way without slamming our neighbors who are joining our communities and paying taxes from other places.
It's a Trumpian concept of the other. Yes. Don't let the other in here. I wrote a column on this a long time ago when this first whole thing started, and I said we have to welcome people and make them feel comfortable, and boy, did I get it in the neck.
That was a good column. I remember reading that. And I think that, you know, the PS is also people need to, you know, if you're coming from a community now, dozens of states that have had high rates of COVID, like New York City did a few months ago, you have to self-quarantine for 14 days and then participate, you know, like anyone else would.
And by the way, this stuff is going on. I know somebody lives in a building in New York and he keeps getting, you know, warnings from the management of the building. You may not have guests. You may not have, you can't have guests and you have to use the back door. You know, there's a certain amount of otherism, anti-otherism, even in the big city.
Absolutely. Kara writes to us and says, why would Thomas resign and not be heard from again, unlike Fauci, who should resign so he can be heard from? That's an interesting
That's a bad letter. Now, I would give it a D-.
And why?
Let me tell you why. Fauci should not resign. Fauci is the voice of reason. It's not as if he's being stifled. You can't turn the television on without seeing CNN or MSNBC or anybody else interview or NPR interviewing the guy. If he was being stifled, maybe yes, but he's not. And as a result, he is as what I like to call contradistinction to the president.
Rosemary.
Well, I have a completely different point of view. He is standing there and allowing the president to say, oh, Fauci doesn't know everything. Look at all the mistakes he made. And Fauci's standing there, which makes it right. It makes it seem like, yeah, that's a reasonable point of view. And it is not. And there is something to protest. We're seeing that in the streets right now. And Dr. Birch and Dr. Fauci and Dr. Redfield are just standing there taking it from a politician who has no business whatsoever making public health announcements. It's wrong. And the way you stand up to wrong things is not to stand there and take it. Doesn't matter.
Boy, I don't know. They're being very contradictory, Rosemary. Yeah. I mean, right? I mean, they're contradicting what he's saying left and right.
They are indeed. And let me tell you, they're what we have right now. It's the voice of sanity. Would you like a bunch of patootie kissers sitting
hey, Ray,
around.
That was your first band, wasn't it? The Patootie Kissers? Yeah, it was.
He is a patootie kisser. Quitting not that.
Oh, I don't believe that.
The idea of politicians, the whole politicization, I don't think we can get away from that now. But wearing a mask or not has become a political decision. Social distancing or not, going to a Trump rally, those are now all political, not health decisions. So Fauci and Birch have not been effective in the very job that they have dedicated their lives to.
Okay, but the president is not allowing them to be effective in their jobs.
Wait. The Fauci comes on every day. Everywhere you say, everybody should wear a mask. If you wear a mask, we'll cut this thing down by 60%. He says it all. Now, there will be many of us who listen to Fauci assiduously. So the idea that somehow, because he's there and not totally effective in the face of a president who says, don't wear a mask, I think is just not right.
All right. Fauci needs to stay where he is because this is literally life and death in public health, and it must be so maddening for him. But as Alan says, his voice is being heard, and far more Americans listen to Fauci on health issues than the president.
Like the fact that he walks 4 miles every day.
All right. Went through this with Reagan and HIV, and apparently he didn't learn any tricks from that experience. He's doing the same thing, sitting there and being pummeled by the politicians. And supposedly he's working behind the scenes to change Trump's mind. Name one other person who ever changed Trump's mind about anything.
Yes, but Trump is the president, and he's there. And if he wasn't there, there would be a patootie kisser who would be saying nothing, and at least we have him.
All right, we're going to take a break.
That's PK.
The PKs, yes. We'll take a break. We have news with Ray Graff. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. 8 minutes past 10 o'clock. Alan Chartok, Judith Enk, Aaron Pasitti, and Rosemary Armeo all join us on this Friday edition. We also welcome you panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. Aaron Pasitti, you are up. Hiring outlook remains dim with, quote, scarring in the economy. What kind of scarring are we talking about?
Very lasting scarring. So the main concern right now is the prevalence of joblessness. There were another 1.3 million people who signed up for new unemployment insurance claims, which is down a little bit since the previous week. But I can't stress this enough. This is like 6 to 7 times more than the historical average. And the concern is that all of the jobs that have been gained in the last employment report were essentially people who were on temporary layoff. So the jobs that are coming back are not the result of new hiring, you know, that creates broad-based economic growth, but just businesses hiring workers that they temporarily laid off back. So the concern is that the scarring argument is that the people who have lost their job and are not getting hired back are going to have to wait a really, really, really long time for the economy to recover before you start to see any type of new job growth. So, you know, for workers who have lost their job and are unemployed for a long period of time, you know, their skills depreciate and they become less attractive to employers. So the risk of long-term unemployment, you know, unemployment rates around 10% for a couple of years is certainly not out of the question. And, you know, for economists, that is absolutely it was incomprehensible, you know, 6 months ago.
So when you look at that yes, 6 months ago, but here we are. So when you see these numbers and then you think about, because there seems to be a disconnect of the report last week and then the numbers that we're seeing today with jobless. I mean, do we have a really good sense of really how long, especially as these spikes go? Because this confused me last week when they said that the numbers came out, the numbers were good or better than expected at least. And meanwhile, it didn't even include the spikes that also happened in the month of June. So I don't really even understand that model.
So, so most people pay attention, as they should, to the Bureau of Labor Statistics monthly employment report. That is the, you know, the household survey of, 60,000 individuals, 150,000 businesses that give you a very complete picture of what's happening in the labor market. The problem is that information, all of that survey information on which the unemployment rate is based, comes from a survey conducted in the second week of the month. So the, you know, the impressive job gains, the 11.1% unemployment rate, all come from the second week in June. Obviously, a lot has happened since then. So what you're seeing is that a monthly report is not timely enough to capture how rapidly things are changing. And again, an 11.1% unemployment rate is the highest unemployment rate the U.S. economy has experienced since the Great Depression. The fact that that is, you know, cause for celebration should be a reminder of just how weak the economy is. But I think a lot more what does not bode well for the future is that high unemployment is here to stay for the foreseeable future. The unemployment rate, the growth rate of the economy, all of that is going to follow the virus. And it's very clear that the U.S. does not have this under control. So trying to forecast when we're going to get back to normal is near impossible. So the long-term pain is just starting, and it's going to be here for years. And that's frightening because we had an economy that was, finally starting to benefit low-wage workers, disadvantaged workers, and all of that's gone. So this is going to increase inequality. It's going to decrease opportunity, not only for, lesser educated groups, but also higher educated groups. So this is very broad-based, and the pain is here for the foreseeable future.
It seems like the question that always comes out of this is, obviously, what effect will it have on the presidential election? We are 115 days, 14 hours, 46 minutes, and 47 seconds away from the election. So what will these numbers, have more importance, or will they just sort of get lumped in with everything else?
I think they will have more importance. I think Trump is creating a false choice. You either shut down the economy or you control the virus. Those are not two mutually mm-hmm. exclusive options. You get the economy back on track by controlling the virus. You prevent shutdowns of businesses and mass layoffs by controlling the virus. He has made that exceptionally clear that he has no will or is even willing to admit that this pandemic is going to be around for a while. He's trying to will this pandemic out of the equation. And if he does that, things are going to get a lot worse between now and November. I mean, you might have these bright pockets of, hey, the unemployment rate went down from 15% to 11%. But I think given how high the unemployment rate is, that will certainly be a factor in the November election. And I think he's honestly, I don't want him reelected, but he's shooting himself in the foot by not trying to control the virus, enact more stimulative fiscal policy measures, to the detriment of both the economy and public health.
I don't think I'm alone on this. When it comes to reopening, I don't get it. I mean, I'll just admit defeat. I don't get it. I'm reading reports and seeing that there's a 33% positivity rate in Arizona. And meanwhile, they're talking about changing the number of people but they still have the restaurants open for inside dining, and they're looking at 50% capacity. I don't get it. I really don't understand it when it comes. I mean, I understand the economics of it, obviously. Judith, I think you were going to start to say something. I just don't. These things, none of this makes sense to me as we have these discussions.
I'd like to register to participate when I can.
Absolutely.
Go ahead, Judith.
Well, sure. I think the Republican governors decided to politicize this profoundly important health issue. And Trump does not want to recognize that the economy is linked to the virus. Yesterday, we had the largest single increase in reported incidences of the virus, over 67,000 cases were reported yesterday. There's always a lag between getting the virus, if you're, quote, lucky enough to go to the hospital, and then the death lag. So Trump has encouraged the states to reopen rapidly. And, the people that live in those states have paid the price. And what I think is so nutty, and I kind of agree with you, Joe, that I don't get it, is it's not just that he pushed the states to reopen early and rapidly, but then there's no mandatory masking program. There's indoor dining. It's as if these states like Arizona and Texas and Florida did not learn from what happened in New York City and other states. It's not binary. It's not open mm-hmm. or closed. It's if you're going to partially reopen the economy, you do it in a sensible way. And mm-hmm. the mistake was the way the states reopened, and now Trump is pushing the very same thing on schools, threatening to hold back, which he doesn't have the right to do, but threatening to hold back financial support to schools if they don't fully reopen. It's Groundhog Day. He's just making the same mistake over and over again, thinking he can tweet away a virus, but it's just not working and people are suffering.
Alan?
Well, I think what Judith said is profound, and I think what she said in the beginning is the most important thing. In many cases, these are Republican governors. It's that simple. And they don't dare deviate from what the master puppeteer has to say, about this. And they will, if there is any justice in the world, be held accountable for having caused all of these deaths, because that's what they're doing. You know, it's as if, as Judith says, it's not binary. It's not. You get on one side is opening and the other side. You can open, but you have to open with everybody with a mask in their face. And this guy, Trump, who wants reopening, is also the one who is saying no masks. That's unbelievable.
Rosemary?
I don't have much more to add. I think that you've covered it. I am mystified at his magical thinking, and worse that there are so many people who seem to go along with it, not just Republican governors, but thousands of people who go to his rallies, who are not wearing masks, who are creating, the internet is filled with the scenes they're creating in stores and public places around the country, saying we don't have to do this, you're trampling on my rights. I don't recognize this country sometimes. I'm having a really hard time, as you know, sympathizing with them.
I mean, just some of the numbers that we have so far that came out yesterday, a new record for coronavirus cases. We're at 59,880 cases, 60,000. And you'll remember just 3 weeks ago, Dr. Fauci said that we could hit 100,000 a day by the end of the summer. And it certainly seems that we're headed in that direction. The New York Times reports that the U.S. surge is being driven largely by states that moved to reopen early. Mm-hmm. That's what we feared, and it seems to be the case. And meanwhile, where we were 3-4 months ago, where hospitals were straining under this flood of new patients, what we saw in New York, what we saw in the Tri-City area, is happening in other parts of the country right now, and that's what we're looking at. Meanwhile, the president is planning a rally in New Hampshire, and Republicans in New Hampshire are saying they are concerned and say that it's not what we need right now. The governor's not even going to attend. So it is a weird place and a weird time, and hard to make sense of it.
I don't want to use the word Holocaust because it's inappropriate. There's nothing like the Holocaust, although there have been some very, very bad actions that have cost millions of lives on parts of people. But in the end, this president, by not doing what is right here, is causing tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of deaths when it's all over. And, you know, that there's no law that says you can hold them responsible for that. But there sure should be.
You know, Alan, I agree with you completely. The other thing, too, that I don't think gets talked about enough is the fact that the president the other day said, you know, 90% of these cases are harmless. I think I'm including probably everyone on this panel, but if you know anyone who has had coronavirus, it is awful. I mean, just awful. And while they may not be dying, it is still a horrible, horrible illness for many, not all, but certainly many. And to even wish that upon anyone, or to turn your back on the fact that people are getting that gravely ill, seems to be a great dereliction as well.
I think the big problem here, Joe, is that we have too many numbers, 100,000, 50,000 people. That is not a face. That is not somebody's grandmother or grandfather,
right,
or son or daughter. Some of these cable news operations are saying, okay, here's the face of one of them. But that hardly does justice to what is going on here. And I just want to say one more thing, and that is when Chris Cuomo got it and described how his lungs ached and he couldn't breathe, that did more, I thought, to put a face on this than anything else we've seen.
Also, though, when you're seeing in Arizona, you know, 33% of the people have it. I mean, you're going to, it seems that those numbers are going to change of people who know somebody who has it. And those are huge numbers.
Will they vote for Trump after they've got it?
Yeah, I don't, that's the thing. And it's Florida and Tennessee yesterday recorded their highest death tolls for a single day. And out of the last 10 days, there have been 6 days where there has been a daily record for cases. Aaron, anything on that?
Yeah. So, you know, from I'll talk about the economic side first and then the political and public health. You know, this outbreak in new cases, just like happened in mid-March, is a pretty good leading indicator of which way the economy is going to go. So, you know, where we're seeing the surge in cases, we're starting to see an uptick in the fatality rate. You know, that's going to manifest itself in pretty ugly and substantial hardship for a lot of people in the subsequent months. So, you know, when you see these spikes in new cases, you know, buckle your seatbelt because the economy is probably going to move in the opposite direction, you know, in the next few months. From a political point of view, going back to the, you know, the fact that Trump isn't even asking people to wear masks, I think that's part of his delusion, is that if you wear a mask, then you're admitting that the virus is real, right, and that people need to protect themselves from it. So I think I wish I could take credit for that. That was Paul Krugman's point in his morning column, that by wearing a mask, you're admitting this is real. And Trump has been trying to will this pandemic away since mid-March. So I think a lot of people's confusion of, listen, I just don't get it. Like, why is every other country gets it? Well, we have a president and an administration that is refusing to acknowledge its existence and therefore refusing to take the appropriate steps, no matter how painful in the short term, to deal with it. So the result is going to be a really long-term bumpy ride.
Aaron, you use the word delusion. Delusion connotes that he doesn't know. I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure that this bully, braggart guy knows full well he's causing deaths. And it still doesn't care because it's good for him to make that argument.
I don't think he – surely – well, if you accept what you just said, that, you know, he acknowledges it, then surely he has to acknowledge that, you know, deaths nationwide are bad for his reelection probability. So if that's the case, then why isn't he doing more about it?
I don't know, but his numbers keep going negatively. But his numbers keep going down.
Well,
and, you know, he stays with – yeah, sorry.
Go ahead.
The disproportionate impact of people who are dying are largely black and brown people. And in the middle of this, the Trump administration is in the courts to repeal Obamacare. I think he's, you know, I've long felt, you know, this is kind of a twisted, tragic way to look at this, but I long felt that if the, you know, the damage was done first in the states that are having this crisis now, Florida, Arizona, Arkansas, Alabama.
Yep.
I think Trump would have reacted differently. I don't think he really cared about people in Seattle, in New York City, getting the virus. It played into the other. I know this is a very unkind thing to say, but he probably did a political calculation that those are, he's not going to win those states anyway. But now that people are suffering in states that he's trying to win, we still have not seen him shift, though. So I think Alan is right. I think this is more calculated on his part. And he and his advisors still don't fundamentally understand the economic implications of having a skyrocketing COVID case. And I just briefly want to go back to something Aaron said earlier in the show that is so important. The impact on low-wage workers is astonishing. You know, essential workers like people working in supermarkets. I have a friend from Texas in the environmental community. She and I testified on the same panel the other day in Congress. And she talked about how coronavirus is affecting her community in Texas, how her mother works in a supermarket and has had coronavirus twice. Mm. Every member of her family has had coronavirus. And, you know, when you're in a supermarket and you've had it twice, there's a good chance you're not going to go back to the job, nor may you have the opportunity to go back to that job. So the disproportionate impact of how this illness is devastating families and communities really needs to be noticed and is just not a factor for President Trump.
Rosemary?
I think that we're underplaying, all of this is all true and valid. I think we're underplaying one thing, which is that Trump is a gambler. And he has gambled wrongly up to now that the virus would just go away. I still think he's gambling now that people are going to forget about it, that they'll look at something else, his latest dazzling array. He's he is gambling that his bravado will win. I also think he enjoys that the odds are so much against him right now. That's how he won in 2016. It's the single trope that he goes back to all the time, that amazing win in 2016. I think he wants to do it again because, like many addicts, I think he's an addict.
Great point. Let's do two letters and then we'll go to a break. Eric says, I heard Alan's hesitancy to mention it, but I have to admit I couldn't help but think of the comparison as well to the Holocaust. As the death toll keeps rising, this president can now begin his own casualty statistics, much like those horrible dictators of the 30s and 40s. The reality of this statement is horrifying. We also go to John, who says, if you think of Trump as a Russian asset, things become clear. He has brought the U.S. to our knees, dividing us and lowering our standing in the world. He will also be seen in the future as a mass murderer. We go to this letter from Judith, who says, while Republicans see the most virus cases... there's words missing in that, so I'm going to skip that letter. My apologies. We go to Leslie, who said, a friend told me the other... Please pre-read your note before you send it to us. A friend told me the other day of two of her friends visiting the area from Florida, not staying with her, who are not quarantining at all. This makes me furious and is why we can't get complacent. People will bring the virus from other more infected areas. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, 33 minutes past 10 o'clock. We have a few moments here before we end, about 15 minutes, and I want to get to some letters. Before we do that, however, I would like to talk about the a new climate report that came out this week. All these reports are fairly sobering, but this one said that showing that the young climate activists clamoring today for rapid cuts of the world's fossil fuel emissions could be well into their 30s or 40s before the impact of those changes becomes apparent. That, according to scientists in a study that was published this week, as if curbing climate change wasn't tough enough already, the new research finds that even if humans sharply reduce greenhouse gas emissions now, cutting carbon dioxide, methane, and other pollutants by at least 5% or more a year, it could still take decades before it's clear those actions are beginning to slow the rate of Earth's warming. Judith.
Sigh. Yes. I mean, this is important. And this is a long game. We know that it's going, we've never warmed the planet like this. And so it's going to take a long time to cool it. And the longer we wait to dramatically reduce CO2 emissions and methane emissions, the harder it will be. So I think this is so important, and this is a call to action. We need to get off of fossil fuels, the way buildings are heated and cooled. We need to change transportation choices. We need to divest our New York State pension funds from fossil fuel. Not only would that be better for the planet, but fossil fuel stocks are tanking. Why State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli refuses to divest money from fossil fuels, I don't know. So, even when the economy was practically shut down for months, we only saw modest reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. And that's because we're so locked in to a fossil fuel economy. There's been some important developments of late with pipelines being canceled. The price of solar and wind is going way, way down. And so I think this is a reminder that it's going to take a long time to address this damaging trend. But two final things. One is the longer we wait, the harder it is going to be to reverse these trends. And we have to be able to juggle more than one catastrophe at a time. Obviously, the world's attention and resources will be on fighting the COVID-19 virus. That doesn't mean that you put the climate change issue aside. And then secondly, even though it's going to take a long time to reverse climate change trends, there are co-benefits of not burning fossil fuel. It means fewer asthma attacks. It means less acid rain. Those air quality improvements will be experienced sooner than what is projected in this research in terms of the climate impacts. But, you know, the most important thing is electing a new president in November so the United States can get back in the game of driving down greenhouse gas emissions and not just watching us go off the cliff.
So I asked Aaron this question, and I'll ask it to you as well. Does it become an election issue?
Yes, absolutely. There's been recent polling showing that climate change and the environment actually is now in the top three issues that voters are looking at. That is a big change from even just a few years ago. I definitely think climate change is an election issue. It affects how people will vote, particularly suburban women. And also, you know, I know there's a lot of skepticism about young people voting, but there were a lot of young people in the streets, not just on the climate change issue, groups like the Sunrise Movement and 350 doing amazing work with young people, but also the Black Lives Matter movement. And those are connected. It's often low-income communities of color that are most devastated by the impacts of climate change. I think this is going to be a very dominant issue in the 2020 election, not just in the presidential race, but also in other congressional and state races.
I hope you're right, but my question to you would be, we see the COVID on headlines every day. You turn CNN on, and in the first break, you never get to any other news. No Trump news, anything. It's all COVID. So my question to you would be, Judith, since we all know, thanks to your tutoring and your help on this, that there will be many, many, many deaths as a result of this, how come it never really gets the attention it deserves?
Well, you know, I think that's a question for all media outlets. It's this long, slow, you know, crisis. It's not dramatic unless it's, you know, a Category 4, Category 5 hurricane hitting. You know, remember Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico? That got a lot of media coverage and then it went away. I have lots of criticism in terms of how the media is covering the climate change issue. And you're right, unless there's a sustained and accurate level of reporting, we're not going to get the action we need. But it's almost like COVID. The science is the science. I loved that intro to me saying the science is the science. And even with limited media coverage, the earth is warming, sea level rise is happening, you know, tremendous heat waves are killing hundreds of thousands of people around the world, agricultural crops are failing, there's more Lyme disease, there's more tick-borne illness in our region.
Can I stand up as usual getting for the media here?
Yes.
Good luck.
Okay, so that's not the job of the media, Judith. There's no way that any journalist in the world, me included, would pick coverage, more sustained coverage with limited resources, more sustained coverage of a crisis 30 years out or that 30 years before we see results and possibilities of what could happen with an immediate 130,000 dead and the numbers rising. If that's immediate and it's an impact that you see right away, that's what the media is equipped to cover. Kind of thing that you're talking about, sustained attention to an action, is government action, and that's what's lacking. So go ahead and complain about the media, but that's not the job of the media. It's the job of our government officials.
Yeah, I totally disagree, because the impacts of climate change are here now. They are here today.
Well, so is COVID, and they're right in our backyard. They are our grandfathers and our grandmothers. You're talking about Arctic changes, and that is extremely hard to bring to the attention of people. And you're wrong that we don't cover it. It's everywhere. There are whole magazines and issues of newspapers devoted to that. But it's not having the impact that you want, because that kind of crisis does not have the same impact as coronavirus.
I mean, I have to say this is anecdotal, but, you know, we can do an entire show on this program and have you on, Judith, and we'll still get letters from people that we never talk about the subject. And yet,
right.
I don't know. I mean,
right.
I don't know how much we could do, you know, even more than what we do on it. But it understood. A couple letters. We go to.
There is science thing, too, where. You can say, well, these are the possibilities of what can happen. That, again, does not have the impact of saying this is what coronavirus is doing yesterday. This is what it might do. This is what it's going to do today. I wish the media had the power that you're imputing to it.
Yeah, it does. And the climate change impacts are here and now. They're not being explained. And I don't think we should underestimate the impact of the deception that was brought by the fossil fuel industry for decades, telling us that climate change was not an issue, just like cigarette smoking is not an issue. Asbestos is not a problem. So a big part of this is the tens of millions of dollars in advertising by the fossil fuel industry and their allies in think tanks in Washington trying to sow confusion on this. And you have this media situation where it's, well, you know, there's this side and there's that side. There is climate change, there's not climate change. That's fundamentally wrong. 99% of scientists, independent scientists, say climate change is real. So there is a lot to be said about how the media fell for the deception campaign by the fossil fuel industry for decades and continues to.
I mean, we can debate this. The news media has not fallen for it, and the coverage of fossil fuel deception has been very similar to the tobacco industry. But you're right that advertising is a whole different thing, and that has been extremely effective. Plus, there's the whole thing that people want fossil fuel. It makes their lives so much easier to keep on continuing the way it used to be, which is part of the problem with coronavirus, too.
We have 4 minutes. Anybody else want in on this? All right. Hearing none, I will go to other letters. We go to Joseph, who says, Alan is right. Again, he is right. Human face is more important than the number of deaths, and we should talk more about individual people dying. As Stalin used to say, one person's death is a tragedy. 1 million deaths is just a statistic.
And Stalin should have known, because he caused 1 million deaths.
Right. Nick says the roundtable's assumption that Donald cares about anyone is very wrong. Reporters need to keep that in mind whenever they're talking about Trump. Hank says, why isn't it obvious to anyone on the panel that Trump's plan all along is to create as much death and chaos as possible before the election? If anything, it's a form of voter suppression, but also a way to delay or stop an election from occurring. Trump knows exactly what he's doing, and nobody wants to accept that. It explains all of his actions to this point.
Mm-hmm.
We go.
Yeah, that's possible.
Go ahead.
He might be creating so much chaos that there is a rebellion, not amongst his base, but amongst people who voted for him in 2016, who were finally saying enough is enough.
Right. Well, that's exactly what the polls say are happening. And I don't think he expected to lose control of this health situation to the extent that he has.
Right. He, you know, all of the chaos he created, he also controlled the narrative of that chaos. This is the one thing he can't control the narrative on, and it's, God willing, going to backfire on him.
You know, this is terribly, pardon me, terribly important stuff, Joe, but I wanted to read one important letter that we got. It says, important, dear panel.
I need you near the microphone, Alan.
Oh, yes, that's quite right.
That's okay.
It was
I
in my lap.
I couldn't hear you.
Yeah.
That's fine.
No, you're so right. You're so right. He says, important, says Nicholas. Dear panel, respectfully, Fig Newtons. Nicholas from Westfield.
Yes. Have you had any yet?
No,
you're waiting until after the, yeah.
Yeah, I shouldn't be eating any of it. But
No, but they're still good. Those raspberry Newtons are very good, too.
No,
you have
that's
to be
just,
fig?
That's just wrong.
It's like a blueberry bagel?
Yes.
Okay. Dave says, considering the bleak projections on the economy and unemployment rate, why does the Dow still flirt with record highs? Want to tackle that one in 1 minute, Aaron?
Yes. The Dow is responding to the the Federal Reserve and the government response to this. If you look at short-term trends, you're going to see some ups and some downs. But given how long this crisis is clearly going to persist, I think the stock market will probably have a similar trend over the next couple of years.
You have come in right on time. I thank you very much for that. My thanks to our wonderful panel this morning. Alan, thank you very much. Enjoy the Fig Newtons and a good weekend.
Well, thank you. You too.
Thanks to Judith and Aaron and Rosemary. We'll be back with the Congressional Corner right after this.